This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Dave Grohl, who has his guitar to play and sing a few songs for us. He founded the band Foo Fighters, which was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame last month. HBO just showed the ceremony last weekend. The first time Grohl was inducted was as the drummer for the band Nirvana. Foo Fighters was inducted by Paul McCartney, who made several comparisons between his life and Grohl's. He said that they each joined a group. For McCartney, it was the Beatles. For Grohl, Nirvana. Both groups faced tragedy. Both groups broke up. And McCartney and Grohl were faced with the question, what do you do now? Each of them answered by making an album in which they played all the instruments themselves. For Grohl, that was the first Foo Fighters album, which was an album he recorded by himself. He didn't put together the band until after recording the album. McCartney went on to describe Foo Fighters as one of the greatest rock and roll bands in the world. Dave Grohl has a new memoir that describes his life from the first time he picked up drumsticks instead of using his teeth as percussion instruments, to his years as the drummer with the punk rock band Scream, living with the band in a van, then joining Nirvana, living part of that time in a squalid home with Kurt Cobain, how his life changed when Nirvana broke through to international success, how he couldn't even listen to music after Cobain died by suicide, the incredible success Grohl's had with his own band where he's the guitarist, singer, and main songwriter, and how his life has changed now that he's the father of three. The memoir is called The Storyteller. We recorded this interview at a live streaming event last week. He was in his studio. Dave Grohl, thank you again for coming. Welcome, welcome. So I asked you if you could play a few song excerpts for us, and happily you agreed. And so I'm going to ask you to start one, and this might be your most popular song. You end shows with it. David Letterman had you and the band do it when he got out of the hospital after his heart attack, because it was so helpful during his recovery. But this is also a song that's obviously very meaningful to you as well as to your fans. So by way of introduction, tell us what the song means to you in your life.
Well, I wrote this song, I think, in 1997, and it was at a time in my life where I was coming out of a relationship, but still feeling love and falling in love, and the feeling of the deep connection between two people where it seems so good that you hope that it never ends, even when you ask for it to stop, that you hope it continues. So I wrote this simple riff and put the song together probably in a day and went and demoed it by myself, brought it back to everybody. And I said, hey, I think this is a song that we should record. And we did. It's a very simple riff that sounds like this. I've waited here for you ever long. Tonight I throw myself into out of the red, out of the head, she said. And I wonder, I sing along with you, if everything could ever feel this real forever, if anything could ever be this good again. The only thing I'll ever ask of you, gotta promise not to stop when I say well, she sang. That was the basic idea of the whole song.
That sounded great. Thank you so much for doing that. You know, you started as a drummer, and, you know, you can hear a very percussive rhythmic style in your guitar playing. I guess that's what comes naturally to you.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I've tried to explain this before. I almost look at the strings on a guitar like the different drums in a drum set. So I can't read music. I'm self-taught. So I don't really have any formal sense of theory or scaling or anything like that. But I do look at the strings on a guitar like it's a drum set. So if you imagine the lower strings are kicks and snares, that's where you get a pattern like this. On a drum set, it would be do do da do da da do da do do da do da da da. But with a guitar, it sounds like. And then the cymbals, when the song opens up, you let the other strings ring out, like. So it makes the sound sort of like blossom into this crescendo. And I've always been I'm not a soloist, I'm not a virtuoso, but I'm a really good rhythm guitarist because I look at it like it's a drum set, you know?
So being self-taught, if I asked you what chords you just played, would you say, I don't know?
I do know that it's in D. That's about okay. It. So, but this particular chord, no clue what that is. No idea.
So I have a drumstick question for you. You know, in your memoir, you write that you had one drum lesson. And the teacher, who is a jazz musician, said, hey, you're holding the sticks backwards. It's like the rounded end that you're supposed to be hitting the drums with and not like the thick end. Did you keep playing them that way, especially like in punk bands where you really wanted to cut through?
I did, actually. Yeah. The drummer that I took my one lesson from, the first thing he told me was that I was holding my sticks backwards. For jazz drumming, backward sticks don't work. For loud, brash, dissonant, distorted punk rock, it absolutely works. And so I just wanted to produce the most sound out of any drum. So I thought, okay, if I hold it like a hammer, that might work. And I continued to do that. I still do it to this day.
When you were, I think, in your mid-teens, you were taken to your first punk rock club. And it's like you finally felt like you found your people. You wrote, I saw slam dancing, stage diving, the crowd chanting the words to each song with fists in the air. I was stepped on, shoved, and punched, and I loved it.
I mean, you know, to me, the greatest thing about it was, first of all, this is in Chicago in, I think, 1982. There's this little bar across the street from Wrigley Field called the Cubby Bear. And I think on Sundays, they would have these hardcore punk rock matinee shows with three or four bands. But there was this community of kids that was something I had never seen before. It was my first concert. Like, I'd never seen a band. I had posters on my walls of like Led Zeppelin and, you know, Kiss and Lasers and Dragons and Explosions. I thought that was rock and roll. But when I walked into this little corner bar and realized it was just a small room with brick walls and a few stage lights and a microphone, to me that was so pure and honest and real that. And the band, they knew, they were called Naked Ray Gun, and they knew four chords, and the singer was like on top of my head, and I was against the stage, and it was life affirming because I thought, oh, I can do this.
Now, you also say it released this pent up energy. And what was that energy? Was it anger? Was it rebellion? Was it just like youthful exuberance and love of music? What was it?
I think that, it's funny because my generation was labeled Generation X, I think. And at that point, the term, it sort of implied that you were a slacker or you had a dysfunctional childhood and you were angry or... I don't think I was any of those things. I was a hyperactive kid that was really motivated to do the things that I love to do. I was raised by a single mother who was the most brilliant, wonderful, lovely woman still to this day. She was a public school teacher for 35 years. She took me to jazz clubs. Who wouldn't want that mom, you know? And I don't think that I was very angry. I just loved life and music and was, you know, I was just kind of a hyperactive kid. So when it came to anything but school, I was the worst student in the world. I mean, this is the irony or the embarrassment of my life, that I was the worst student in the school that my mother was a teacher at. So unfortunately, she had to live with her son just completely failing in school until I decided I wanted to make music, and she recognized that that was my thing, and she let me go on and do it. But I just loved the energy. I did love the rebellion and I love the community because it did seem like a tribe of people that didn't necessarily feel like they fit into everyday life. And I felt that way in my little suburb in Springfield, Virginia.
when you were 17, you auditioned for as the drummer for the punk band Scream. You lied about your age.
A gig is a gig, and, you know what I mean?
No, absolutely, absolutely. And you knew all their records, you knew all their songs, you knew like the drum parts, and they were impressed. And so at age 17, you became their drummer. And just can you give us a little taste of what Scream songs were like?
First of all, Scream songs were very fast, okay? So they were considered hardcore punk rock. So it wasn't like the 120 beats per minute, and it wasn't even like kind of a gallop thing like that. The beats were like, they were like this. And so the riffs were usually like... So that would be played like this, like... And so here I am with my sticks held backwards, just like mercilessly pummeling these drum sets. Now, you have to know that I didn't learn to play the drums on a drum set. I learned to play on pillows on my bedroom floor. So I had a pair of marching drumsticks that were oversized. They were really heavy and thick. Playing on pillows that I would set up in the configuration of a drum set and listening to these really fast punk rock records. So it's almost like running in the sand. So after learning on pillows and then I would get on a drum set, I would just destroy the thing. Like my friends never let me touch their drum sets because they they knew, oh God, if he touches it, there's going to be a broken cymbal. There's going to be a broken drum hit. So, I mean, this was that sort of hyperactive energy that I had my entire life, but I was kind of channeling all of that into the way that I played drums. And it felt so good. It felt great. I could close my eyes and think, I'm at Wembley Stadium right now. And then I'd open it and I'd see that there's like six people in the audience. But in my mind, I was, this was rock and roll Valhalla, you know?
Did you have to change your drumming when you started playing with Nirvana compared to Scream?
Well, the two bands are different, for sure. There was a simplicity to Nirvana's music, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's proved to be so effective, in that, like, the guitar playing is very simple. The drumming is very simple. And the production of those records, we would record a song in one or two takes. It was pure and honest and real, and I think when Kurt wrote songs, he really tried to capture that simplicity because he realized that that's kind of a direct route to someone's heart or soul or mind. So basically my drumming for that band, if my drumming in the punk rock band was 250 beats per minute, my drumming for Nirvana, I sometimes liken it to like disco drumming and funk drumming. A lot of those drum riffs that I used in some of those songs, they come from some of my disco drumming heroes,
Can you beat out an example on your guitar?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, there's a song like Come As You Are, or even Smells Like Teen Spirit. There's a term called a flam, which is when you use two sticks to hit the same drum. And rather than hitting at the same time, like this, you stutter them. So it's like... there's space between the two. So if you listen to a Nirvana record, hold on, I'm trying to mute this guitar. If you listen to a Nirvana record, there's a lot of things going like, right? And so that drum lick is, it's been around for ages, but it comes from like the Gap Band or Cameo or Power Station. And it's like danceable songs. So I was basically making these rhythms that were kind of danceable to a vocalist that was screaming at the top of his lungs and guitars that were turned up to 14, So it was very simple and the drumming was very simplified. I think a sign of a great drummer is when their song comes on at a bar and people that don't play the drums air drum along to that song. That to me is the greatest compliment. And I saw that happen.
Wow. That's great. That is really great. Kurt Cobain did have like mood issues, depression. It's hard to be around somebody who's very depressed a lot of the time. And your impulse is to cheer them up. There's really nothing you can do to cheer them up. and people can become very irritable when they're depressed. So I'm interested in the impact of his depression on you and on the band.
Well, you know, at first when I moved up and started living in that small apartment with him, I mean, this was someone that I had never met before. I didn't know. At first I thought maybe he's quiet. Maybe he's shy. Maybe he has, you know, social anxieties, whatever it is. There were times, too, where he was outrageously funny and really fun to be around. You know, I mean, we would, like, the two of us would get $7 and go to the grocery store and spend half an hour in the freezer section looking for the perfect TV dinner. And, like, those those moments were so much fun, you know. So it wasn't always doom and gloom. But, of course, I think there were moments where Kurt would retreat into his own, into his shell, and write is what he did. I think a lot of the times when we'd go to the apartment after rehearsal, I slept on the couch, so I would kind of get on my couch, and he would go in his room and close the door. Little did I know that most of that time he was writing in his journals, and more often than not, the next day at rehearsal, he would have a new song. So I think, you know, he had moments of being introverted and sort of reclusive. But that was also balanced with someone that was pretty fun to be around and pretty great to be in a band with, because, you know, when we counted into a song, it exploded and it was real, man. It was real.
So when he died by suicide, he left a suicide note. And I just want to quote something he says in the note. Well, I'll just paraphrase it. He talked about no longer enjoying performing or playing music anymore and not wanting to have to fake it. No, obviously it was more than that, because he says in that note to his daughter, "You'll be better off without me." But I'm wondering if that scared you, not only his death, which of course was horrifying and it was, you know, a tragedy for him and for everybody who knew him, but did that scare you that maybe someday you'll end up feeling that way and that you won't be able to function after that?
Yeah, it did. And, you know, there are moments where you get that feeling, I think, as a musician or a performer or as an artist. I think that there are times where you hit that wall and you realize that you're maybe not inspired. Maybe you're not into it. Maybe you're just going through the motions. Now, one of the things with my life now, or the Foo Fighters now, is that, you know, I learned a lot of lessons over the years from Scream to Nirvana to the Foo Fighters of what to do and what not to do. I think one of the reasons why our band has survived 26 years as the Foo Fighters is because of those lessons we learned before. And one of the biggest lessons is to know when to say no. And not ever feel like you have to buckle to the pressure of someone else forcing you to make music or to perform or to, you know, do something that you're just, that your heart isn't there for. And that's the way we've worked. And I have to imagine one of the reasons why we've survived this long is because if you get that tinge, that feeling in the back of your mind where you're just punching in and going through the motions, that's when it's time to, like, pump the brakes and stop. And that's what we've always done. And more often than not, you know, you settle and that feeling dissipates. And then you call up your guys and you're like, "Hey, I wrote a bunch of new songs. Let's make another record." That's kind of how it works now.
Since part of, like, your whole way of being was that the band was a family, whether it was Scream or Nirvana, And suddenly, like, you not only had Kurt Cobain, you didn't have that music family anymore.
Yeah, I think that, well, in a way, it brought a lot of us closer together. You know, as musicians, we would strap on our instruments and make a bunch of noise and then kind of go our separate ways when we had some time off. But after Kurt died, I think we all really sort of gathered and rallied around each other just to make sure everyone was okay. So I think a lot of us became much closer after Kurt died. But yeah, I mean, you know, my entire life was about music up until that point. And then, you know, I was heartbroken. And after Nirvana ended, I didn't really know if I ever wanted to play music again. Until I realized that music was the one thing that had healed me my entire life through periods of pain or heartbreak or sadness. And so it saved my life.
Why did you switch from drums to guitar once it was your band?
Well, I mean, honestly, after Nirvana ended, I was asked to join a few other bands as the drummer. And I didn't really want to just sit back down on the drum stool because I thought it would remind me too much of losing Kurt and losing Nirvana. It's almost like, you know, if you stare at the sun, you wind up blinding this little sunspot in your vision. I almost thought of it like that perspective from the drum set. I will always have that sunspot right there in front of me, just to the right. Like that will be there forever. So also, having never done it before, I looked at it as a challenge. You know, people don't bungee jump because they know they're going to make it to the ground safely, you know? It's just as I didn't start to be the lead singer of the Foo Fighters because I thought I was Freddie Mercury from Queen. I'm like, oh God, I've never done this before. Let's see what happens. I'm that guy. I'm like, oh, screw it. Let's try it. Who cares?
Did you have to start really practicing guitar?
And a lot, yeah. For a lot of this stuff that I had to play live, yes.
What did you have to learn that you didn't know?
I mean, honestly, standing up and playing guitar. Like, my entire life, I'd been sitting on a couch playing Beatles songs. And all of a sudden, I'm like, wait, this is horizontal? What? How does that? So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to learn. And, of course, there were really terrifying moments of being so self-conscious where, you know, it's almost like being at a school. Remember your first school dance? When you hit the dance floor, like, tell me that you weren't the most self-conscious you'd ever been in your entire life at that point. People are watching me move. People see that I don't have rhythm. People are, you know, it's a very, like, exposing, vulnerable place to be. That's what it's like being a lead singer, if you're thinking about it. Nobody likes to watch someone dance if they're thinking about it. So I stopped thinking about it.
It has been so wonderful talking with you and hearing you play and sing.
Thank you, Terry. That was really fun. Thank you so much.
Dave Grohl's new memoir is called The Storyteller. Jane Campion won the Best Director Award at this year's Venice International Film Festival for her new movie, The Power of the Dog. It's a Western set in 1920s Montana, starring Benedict Cumberbatch, Kirsten Dunst, and Jesse Plemons. It's now playing in theaters and begins streaming December 1st on Netflix. Our film critic Justin Chang says it's a brilliant return to feature filmmaking for Campion after a long absence.
The great New Zealand writer-director Jane Campion has long been acclaimed for her films about the complex inner lives of women, notably in 19th century dramas like The Portrait of a Lady, Bright Star, and especially The Piano. Her tense and gripping new movie, The Power of the Dog, thus marks something of a departure. It stars a superb Benedict Cumberbatch as a 1920s Montana rancher named Phil Burbank, who's the very picture of rugged American masculinity. Phil seems at one with the land and all its living creatures, whether he's riding a horse, leading a cattle drive, or bathing in a muddy river. He's also a sadist, a fascinatingly conflicted monster, and one of the scariest characters you're likely to meet this year. The movie, which Campion adapted from a 1967 novel by Thomas Savage, looks a lot like a Western, full of somber gray skies and craggy vistas that are magnificently shot by the cinematographer Ari Wagner. But it's more like a tightly wound psychological thriller that just happens to play out on an epic canvas. And it's full of secrets and surprises that it's slow to reveal. We first meet Phil and his brother, George, played by Jesse Plemons, who's his opposite in every respect. Gentlemanly, polite, neatly dressed. The two run a ranch together, and get along fine for the most part, with George genially absorbing every casual insult, like fatso, that Phil throws his way. But everything changes one evening, when they're traveling with their men and stop for dinner at an inn. They're served by the owner, Rose Gordon, played by Kirsten Dunst, and her son, Peter, played by the Australian actor Cody Smit-McPhee. As they're being waited on, Phil sneers at the intricately cut paper flowers decorating the table.
I wonder what little lady made these.
Actually, I did, sir. My mother was a florist, so I made them to look like the ones in our garden.
Oh, well, do pardon me. They're just as real as possible. Now, gentlemen, look, see, that's what you do with the cloth.
It's really just for wine drips.
Oh, you got that, boys. Only for the drip. Now get us some food.
Rose is devastated by Phil's humiliating attack on her son. And George, who knows all too well how cruel his brother can be, is there to comfort her. They soon fall in love and marry. It's worth noting that Kirsten Dunst and Jesse Plemons are a couple in real life, which makes the tenderness of their on-screen marriage all the more touching. George proves a considerate and generous husband, even paying for Peter to attend medical school. But he's unable to protect his new wife from the wrath of his brother. When Rose moves onto the ranch, Phil dismisses her as a gold digger and launches a vicious campaign of psychological abuse, driving Rose into depression and alcoholism. The power of the dog really hits its stride in these moments. Nothing overtly terrible happens, but the emotional violence that Phil inflicts on everyone in his midst is brutal to watch. Campion draws out the tension with exquisite subtlety, aided by an unnerving score by Johnny Greenwood and by four actors who could not be more ideally cast. Few performers can break your heart like Dunst, whose face becomes a landscape of pain as all Rose's initial happiness drains away. Plemons is sympathetic as the decent but ultimately helpless George. In some ways, the most intriguing character here is Peter, who eventually returns home from school to visit his mother and once more becomes a target of Phil's scorn. But Cody Smit-McPhee's watchful, intelligent presence suggests that Peter is a more formidable adversary than he appears. Before long, Peter and Phil strike up an odd sort of friendship, with Phil teaching Peter how to ride a horse and other cowboy rites of passage. But both men's motives remain ambiguous. Cumberbatch has always been a marvelous actor, but he simply outdoes himself here. It's remarkable how easily this elegant British heartthrob, known for playing brainy types like Sherlock Holmes, Alan Turing, and yes, Doctor Strange, slips into the boots and spurs of a man of the Old West. But without giving away too much, there are deeper, more subversive layers to Cumberbatch's performance that feel consistent with Campion's past explorations of gender. It's been 11 years since Campion made a new movie, though in the meantime she's co-written and co-directed two seasons of the crime drama series Top of the Lake. It's wonderful to have her back, making gorgeously unsettling psychodramas in which the wildness of her landscapes matches the inner turbulence of her characters. And speaking of landscapes, the movie was actually shot in New Zealand, which does a pretty good job of passing as Montana. It's just one more way the power of the dog reminds us that appearances can be deceiving, and the most startling truths are often hiding in plain sight.
Justin Chang is film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed Jane Campion's new movie, The Power of the Dog. Coming up, we hear from Will Smith. He's written a new memoir called Will, which deals in part with his complicated relationship with his father, who could be abusive and at times supportive. Our next guest is Will Smith. He has a new memoir and stars in a new movie that's now showing in theaters and streaming on HBO Max. Smith spoke with our guest interviewer, Tanya Mosley, a host of NPR's midday show, Here and Now. Here's Tanya with more.
We all think we know at least a little about Will Smith, right? He's a blockbuster movie star, a musician, a comedian, a social media savant, and for the last two decades, a constant bankable force in Hollywood. It's an image the Philly-born star has carefully crafted, but in his new memoir, aptly called Will, Smith explores another identity, one that has fueled his unwavering work ethic and commitment to being one of the biggest stars of our generation. And that's the identity of a coward. In unflinching detail, Smith explores how that identity was born. When Smith was 9 years old, he saw his father beat his mother. Paralyzed with fear, he stood frozen. It's an impossible position for a child to be in, and yet Smith has carried the burden that he didn't step in to rescue his mother and has spent his entire life trying to make up for it. This is just one of many revelations in Smith's new memoir, Will, which is out this week. Will Smith also has a new movie out this month. It's called King Richard, and it's about how a father turned his dream of making his two daughters, Venus and Serena Williams, into two of the greatest tennis players of all time. Will Smith, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Congratulations on adding author to all of those titles in your list of accomplishments.
Of all of the other, hyphens, this one was the most painful.
I can imagine, because this book is a raw and introspective excavation of your life. You've always been open about your life with the public, but you've said that you felt free to go deep after your father's death in 2016. In what ways did his death free you to write this book?
You know, there were a couple of things. First and foremost, the abuse of my childhood. You know, I saw my father beat up my mother, you know, and that narrative didn't fit into the image that I was crafting. You know, it was embarrassing. You know, there was a person I wanted to be, or a person I thought I had to be able to create the life that I wanted to create. And I just never could have said that out loud while my father was alive, you know, because at the same time, my father was my hero, you know, and my father is largely responsible for all of the blessings and the things that I've been able to go on and create and build. So, you know, that internal conflict was dissolved when my father passed in 2016. And so it was that, and I think the combination of, I felt like I had experienced enough things in my life that I had finally come to the point where I had suffered enough that it's the things that I might say could be valuable.
You know, I interviewed Tarana Burke. She's the founder of Me Too, the Me Too movement, for the show recently. And she made this revelation that sometimes when someone is an overachiever, it's a response to trauma. And your book is grounded in this idea, because you write, to understand your success, we have to understand this trauma that you're talking about. And it starts with your father's anger and your inability as a child to stop him from hurting your mother. I mean, this incident left a permanent mark on how you viewed yourself. You begin the book this way. Can you unpack that for us? And in what ways did that incident leave that mark on you that you felt like a coward?
Yeah, I've since talked to all of my brothers and sisters, and you know, we were not a family that discussed those things. So the writing of the book really freed my siblings and I, and my mother, and even my children and my current family, to be able to explore all of these things. But that moment singularly shaped my childhood identity. I couldn't shake the idea that I had failed my mother and I was somehow unworthy of love and care because of my cowardice. And that's where the beginnings of wanting to overachieve and wanting to create and wanting to win and wanting to build an external life that could somehow and hopefully cover the pain and the low self-esteem, so that the character, that Fresh Prince character, that buoyant, happy, joyful image, was painted over a core of a real lack of self-esteem and self-respect.
I want to get into your relationship with your father and growing up, how that kind of created the person that we know as Will Smith. As you said, you feared your father, Daddy-O, as you called him.
Yeah.
But you also had great reverence for him, as you say. You wanted to feel his softness and approval, which sometimes came in the form of performance. I think that's not surprising, but it's really interesting to know these details because he loved to record you and your brother and sister. And you, of course, were a ham. That attention, it felt like love, but for you, it also was a way to distract him from his anger. Can you say more?
Yeah, you know, my father was one of the greatest men I've ever known. My father was brilliant. My father was wise, you know, and not unlike other little boys. My father was the Superman image in my mind. And that was also one of the things that was difficult about writing this book and telling this story, because as soon as people hear abuse, they paint an ogre in their mind. And, you know, my father wasn't an ogre. You know, my father was both things. My father was deeply brilliant. He never missed a game. He was a beautiful teacher, and you know, he was military minded, and he never abandoned the post of being a father. He put food on the table every night. And all, you know, so it's that dichotomy is part of what breaks the mind of a child in that way, because you can't fit both of those things into one space, you know. So in writing a book, it was really difficult for me because I know that people need the black and white. You know, people need good guys and bad guys and all of that. And my father wasn't a bad guy by a long shot. He was troubled and he overcame many of his struggles to be able to provide a place for his family. And, you know, it was hard for me to feel like I could potentially do a disservice to the multiple aspects of what my father was and have my impressions soil his legacy in a way that would feel not nuanced, you know. So, you know, all of that to say my difficulties and my wounds and the childhood trauma that precipitated the character and personality and the wins are my father played a role on both sides.
You lay it out though so well in the book about, I mean, my gosh, you start with the work ethic of your father and how he imparted that on you and your siblings. But this personality that you created to cope, and I say created, but it also is you. I mean, cheery and upbeat and positive and fun. I mean, you're hugely successful, but have you ever thought about who you might have been if you hadn't experienced those traumas?
You know, that is such a difficult idea. I don't remember. I always hate quoting authors and I don't remember who said it. But there's an idea of the adversity paradox that, you know, as parents, we try to shield our children from adversity, not realizing that the adversity is what makes them strong, that being able to overcome adversity and being able to solve problems and being able to triumph over your difficulties is a really critical aspect. So it's like, if I could go back and change it, would I? And it's no. It's like those difficulties and those traumas and the mental anguish that I had to overcome was a big part of me growing into the person I am today. And I love my life. I'm happier than I have ever been. And it is largely based on the perception of myself that I can survive anything because of what I have been able to overcome. I have confidence in myself. I trust myself to manage whatever God decides I need to triumph against.
Will, what drew you to the role of Venus and Serena Williams' father, Richard?
You know, probably about 20 years ago, I saw, it's a famous video, and I'm sure you have seen it. There was one where Venus is doing an interview and the interviewer keeps asking her about her confidence. And Richard interrupts the interview and slams the person who's asking her the question, you know, saying she's, you know, she answered you with a lot of confidence. You know, you are dealing with the image of a young black child. It's like, you know, she done told you what's happening. Leave that alone. And I remember being blown away at how calm Venus's face was. It was almost a little bit of a smirk, as if she knew she had a lion. And she didn't want to stick her lion on nobody, but if somebody messed with her, her lion would attack and defend. And I just remember, you know, people were talking about how crazy he was. And I'm looking at that, I'm like, how is that crazy? And I loved him from that moment. And then it's when the screenplay was presented to me a couple of years ago, that moment blossomed in my heart again. I was like, I absolutely want to get to know this man. I absolutely want to explore his story. And I absolutely want to try to honor this family and share the ideas that had been vilified and villainized in the world of tennis. I wanted to really dive into the heart of Richard Williams and to be able to shine some light on the core of love for his family that was the beating heart of what he was trying to accomplish.
Right, because what we knew of him back then in the 90s were these clips. But This movie actually kind of tries to give us a full view of how he interacted with his daughters, more about that dream. There's this scene in King Richard where Richard is driving his daughters, Venus and Serena, to a fancy tennis club to play in front of a hotshot coach. And on the way, the houses they pass get bigger and more palatial, and Venus and Serena begin to daydream. Let's listen.
I like that one. Yeah, that one's nice. If that was my house, I'd put a pool in the front and a slide on the roof.
We'll put your pool in the front.
Party. Everybody's gonna want to come to my house.
Oh, you're just gonna be the crazy lady on the block.
Oh, I'm gonna be the coolest person on the block. That one has a tennis court.
Oh, that's the one then. That's the one. You're gonna have any one of these houses you want. Beverly Hills, Hollywood Hills, any of these old hills. Because you got a plan and you're gonna stick to it. As a little boy, my moms used to say, son, the most strongest, the most powerful, the most dangerous creature on this whole earth, it's a woman who know how to think. Ain't nothing she can't do. Y'all know how to think?
Yes, Daddy.
Now these people we about to go see, you gonna show them how dangerous you are?
Yes, Daddy.
Let me see your dangerous face. Will, that's your dangerous face. That's your dangerous face. That's okay, don't do that for the people.
That's a scene from the new film, King Richard. Will, that part when Richard says to Venus and Serena, you two have a plan and you're going to stick to it. I mean, does that dogged determination that Richard exuded feel familiar? It feels familiar for me after reading your book.
Oh, absolutely. Part of my ability to understand Richard Williams is related to my father and slightly to my parenting also. But Richard Williams and my father were from a different generation. You know, they were from a generation where they can fix things with their hands. They build things with their bodies, you know. So it was a completely different mindset that, you know, post-World War II kind of pull yourself up by your own bootstraps kind of mentality. But they also were dreamers that couldn't find support, that could only find degradation and disrespect at every turn. And they were both determined to build a better circumstance for their children. So I could relate to that. I understood Richard Williams through my father's eyes when he would come in after 16 and 18 hour days at work with a hell-bent dedication and determination to feed and elevate his family.
Will Smith, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much.
Will Smith spoke with guest interviewer Tanya Mosley, a host of NPR show Here and Now. Smith's new memoir is called Will. He stars in the new film King Richard, which is showing in theaters and streaming on HBO Max.
Bring it.
On your mark, ready, set, let's go. Dance floor pro, I know you know. I go psycho when my new joint hit. Just can't sit, gotta get jiggy with it. That's it, now honey, honey, come ride. TKNY, all up in my eye. You got a Prada bag with a lot of stuff in it. Give it to your friend, let's spin. Everybody looking at me, glancing a kid. Wishing they was dancing a jig here with this handsome kid. Sick a cigar right from Cuba Cuba. I just bite it, it's for the look, I don't light it. Ill way to hand me on the hand, stay off play. Give it up, jiggy, make it feel like foreplay. Yo, my cardio is infinite. Ha ha, Big Willie style's all in it. Getting jiggy with it. Getting jiggy with it.
Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.
Met Ali, he told me I'm the greatest. I got the fever for the flavor of a crowd pleaser. DJ play another from the...